Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Welcoming all of you in Torino, Italy, who have become devout listeners. Hey, we're talking today about an interesting subject. You know, yesterday's New York Times talks about the contractors from Iraq. The contractors, which meaning not only the soldiers, but the ones who go over there to kill for money. The contractors have been coming back with many, and the soldiers have been coming back with many mental disorders. And here's the question, you know, it reminded me of Vietnam. It reminded me of some of the other things that people, when you ask them to talk about it, they say they can't talk about it. Now, why is it that people can't talk about horrors that they've experienced? I have a friend whose grandmother went through the pogroms of Russia. Now, if you don't know what that was, I'm sure it was part of the Holocaust. It was the persecution of the Jews. The pogroms, I'll read you what it is. In Russia, it's to wreak havoc or to demolish violently in the form of riot directed against a particular group, whether ethnic, religious, characterized by the destruction of their homes, their businesses, their religious centers. Guess where we have pogroms going on now. Usually pogroms are accompanied by physical violence against the targeted people, murder, massacre, and often rape. Term has historically been used to denote extensive violence, either spontaneous or premeditated against Jews, but has been applied to similar incidents against other mostly minority groups. When you talk about the pogroms against the Jews, you weren't talking about a light story there. There you have a young woman growing up in Russia who suddenly perceives that she's no longer safe and her family knows she's not safe, so they drag her away from everything she knows. They pack her bag, you know, and they pack a bag and they have very little belongings and they drag from city to city, from country to country, trying to go someplace where it's going to be safe, never feeling safe. Where this destruction keeps following you, and you're now afraid of three things. Anybody's town you go into, they don't welcome you because they're afraid you're going to welcome the other stuff that comes in. So they're against you. Everybody hates you. You're afraid you're going to get killed. You're told you have to be quiet and silent and not say anything. Now, what's a 4 or 5 year old girl supposed to do with this? What does she do with her mind when this is happening? What happens to the mind, a switch for a moment, of a Vietnam soldier who's sitting in a who's sitting in a swamp somewhere, you know, who's dug out in a foxhole, and he's being bombarded and attacked, and he has a friend next to him who's dead, whose head was blown off, and the guy's sitting there in this foxhole terrified, and he knows he has to go to the bathroom, and the only place he could go to the bathroom is in his pants, because he knows he can't move, and he might die any minute now, and he's terrified. His mind, what happens to his mind? What happens to you when you have that freeze? What happens when you're a victim of it in childhood, of an insane violence? That's such that your mind just can't handle it anymore. Well, this is one of the reasons that people have this gift, which is to amnesize, which is to forget, to actually put it at a distance. Because if you were to remember the horror over and over again, it would be hard to function. You'd just shiver in fear. Today's program is about objectification, but I'll tell you another element of this. So this is one. This is one where we take these tremendous things that happened and we say, oh, what horrors they were, but why can't you talk about it? Why? Why? What's the problem with talking about it? As in with so much tragedy, what's the problem? What do you mean you don't want to talk about it? And here's what I discovered. What I discovered is that the reason people don't like to talk about the places that were so horrible in their life was because at the time they became somebody that they never want to become again. It's not that the situation was so horrible that they never want to be in the situation again. It's that they became something that they never want to become again. Picture yourself, you know, sometimes you think of these cartoons of a mouse that's drenched or a cat that's drenched and it's shivering and it's scared. You know, like imagine if you get so scared that you're just shivering and you have nothing left in your survival. And you get this feeling comes over you. Your body is flooded. Your mind is gone. You can't think. You're in a total, total panic, like sometimes you feel when you wake up from a horrible dream. You live that. And the thing is not that it is so horrible. The thing is that you lost yourself. You, in this situation, became a different person. So any of you who have tragic memories and you think back of the memories, like think back of, I used to have one. I remember I had a dog that died when I was 9 years old, and it was a big tragedy to me, and I didn't want to think about it. If I ever heard a car screech, dog was killed by a car, I used to just close off my mind. Why? Because I had to go back into it to examine it, to say, why am I closing off the screech of every car? As if it's reminding me, because not only did it reminded me, but it reminded me of me, the powerlessness and the guilt I felt for allowing the dog to get killed by a car by not watching it more closely. So the question becomes, my friends, when we objectify something, sometimes it is because we don't want to feel who we were at that time. Now, let's take a classic examination brought up by a classic example brought up by the feminists nowadays. They talk about men's objectification of women. Why would men objectify women? And in this case, we'll talk about men and the way they use women for sex and see women just as a sexual object and nothing else, and they kind of don't see a woman as a person. Men who objectify women, according to my theory, according to my presentation, somewhere in that man's early life, he felt a horrible feeling with women, probably his mother, that he never wanted to feel again. So what he did was he objectified the women. He put them at a distance. So he would never have to feel that powerlessness and that neediness that he felt in childhood. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. You know, and if you think about it, and now you think about many of the men who objectify women, they're clearly afraid of women. Clearly. I mean, there's no intimacy allowed. They won't get close. They jump from one to the other. They lie. They create illusions. So it goes even one step further than this, and I hope I'm not getting too complex because I think it's a really valuable contribution here. Sometimes people take an incident of their life and they objectify it. Now, by definition, objectification, let me give you where's the definition? Here it is. Objectification, by definition, is taking any object, place, or thing and turning it into a focus of energy, that it becomes the focus. In fact, wait, I just have here it is. Process by which people assign meanings to things, people, places, activities, and the like. Thus, they become part of a cultural construction which inform and guide people's behaviors. But it's when a person doesn't deal with another person as an object, as a person, but as an object. But you could objectify even the horrors to exaggerate them. So let's say your parent neglected you as a kid. Now you can objectify your parents' neglect and say they abandoned me. And you can now reject your parents and reject all forms of parenting. If you say to yourself, there's no one to trust, I can't trust anybody, you've objectified everybody. Because in truth, there is somebody you could trust. In truth, there is somebody who will love you. So when you make a global expression and you say something like, a generalization, and you say nobody will ever, nobody can. What you're doing is you're putting it out there, because if you put it out there that way, if you objectify that which you need, then you never feel the need for it. Nobody will ever love me. Nobody will ever love me means you never feel the need for the love. You just feel the depression of nobody loving you. But a more painful thing is feeling the yearning. Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Is this very confusing? It's a really interesting concept because from a number of different points of view, you know, we objectify all the time. You know, there's a thing called dehumanization. Dehumanization is a process where members of a group simply assert the inferiority of another group through subtle or overt acts or statements. Dehumanization may be directed by an organization such as a state or the Ku Klux Klan, or may be the composite of individual sentiments and actions such as prejudice, a form of de facto racism. State-organized dehumanization have been directed against perceived race or ethnic groups, such as the pogroms. That was dehumanizing. In other words, what we say are people are not human. We reduce them. We make them less than human. And everything that was going on in Bosnia, what goes on in Africa, what goes on in Iraq, and what's going on and what went on in pogrom, all of that was dehumanizing. You don't see. I mean, don't we dehumanize when we think about bodies in Iraq? When we think about the civilians that are dying there, that are dead, you know, we don't think about those. We think of the number of soldiers who come back here. Do we think about the hundreds of thousands of dead? No, we dehumanize in a way. That's our safety. It's our protection. So, since the mind has the capacity to put at a distance anything that is grossly painful, anything that is painful, and sometimes make it bigger than it is, worse than it is, I don't trust any man. Imagine a woman saying that. All men want only this. Or men saying, all women just want my money. Right? By doing that, you protect yourself from the you that needs. And that's what we're talking about today, the needy you. What do you need? You know, how do you protect yourself from your needs? How big is your need? You know, how big is it? I mean, do you need people? Yesterday was Independence Day, as if that means anything with all the bombs and firecrackers and everything else that goes off, as if that has any meaning. It does to me because I always think of it as Interdependence Day, not just a play on words. I think of how we need each other, how I need you, how you need me, how I need the people who help me right here. You know, in the studio and in places, the people around me, how I need you, the audience, to send me letters and tell me what you think. How we need the station WBAI, you know, how we need it. And we don't want to experience that need. We want to push it at a distance. We need each other. Our telephone number here is 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. We're going to be taking your calls a little later, but we're going to talk about objectification. And I want to talk about how we objectify. We objectify people and places. And how we do it. I mean, why we do it. You know, in Russia, as I was saying, you know, there was a series of things that took place from the 18th century going on, where in Russia there was just persecution after persecution after persecution. If you ever want to look it up, look up pogroms, P-O-G-R-U-O-M-S. And read the history of it. P-O-G-R-O-M-S. Pogroms. Sexual objectification is, of course, there's a lot of attitude about that. Now, you know, when you think about objectification, you can also think of sexual fetish as objectification. Now you take, let's say, your preference for somebody's shoes, be it man's boots or woman's high-heeled shoes. And what you've done is you've objectified the need into a shoe or a boot or a garter belt or a whip or whatever else you objectify it with. It's like you convert the need into an object. What's important about a man? I meet a man, what's important about him is he has to have good teeth, someone said to me the other day. Great teeth, objectification. He has to have great teeth. Because that tells me how he cares about himself. No. Because it tells you how he might care about you should you ever need him to take care of you. Because in your mind, if he can't take care of his teeth, then he can never take care of you. See what I mean? Shine shoes. You know, as if these make the difference in people. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. We will take one of your calls if we can. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille. All right. Okay. We're going to start right now. Nio Tomori? Oh, my God. Here we go. Heidi, you're on the air.
Armand DeMille?
You got me.
I heard you talking about dehumanization.
Yes.
I have two comments. I believe that every time we give examples of dehumanization in other countries, particularly powerful ones like the pogroms, that we need to speak about what has occurred at home, like slavery.
Absolutely.
And the other thing I've been very concerned about are the bodies exhibits. You know, those bodies down around South Street Seaport that have been stripped of their skin, and we see advertisements for them all over the city. And whenever I look at these bodies, they look African, Black, Asian, and it makes me very concerned that someone is trying to desensitize the American citizens, and perhaps they're hoping to have something akin to pogroms here in the U.S.
Maybe. It's an interesting thing. I went down to the body exhibit. As a scientist, I wanted to see what it was. I didn't see anything cultural that I was looking at, and it seemed to, when they picked the examples, they seemed to come from many different places, many from China. But the rest of what you're saying is important here, because you see, when you see it and you think about something happening here in America, or you think about the different dehumanizations, do you think for a moment, what's your name, by the way?
My name is Ima.
Ima, do you think about the dehumanization of Ima? Do you ever think about it? Do you ever think about where that happens and where that's happened and what that was like?
Oh, yes. I think about it all the time.
Yeah. Where did it happen? Ima, as a kid, right?
Yes.
As a kid, when we were trying to get by, how did you? I mean, you're my best example. Of course you're going to be able to spot it because you lived it. Where would you say was the dehumanization of Ima?
What happened inside my household, and it happened in the community that I grew up in.
How did it happen?
In my household?
Yeah.
It happened because of racism and the internalization of racism among many cultures that live here, and they've come to value straight hair and light skin.
So in your house, there was that prejudice of the straight hair and the light skin.
Some people were dark and some people were
light.
And
it came down to you, and you felt that you were on the dark side without the right hair, right?
No, I was on the light side, so I was told that I wasn't even, on many occasions, I was even told I was adopted.
Right, so more dehumanization. And what did that, now how does a child's mind deal with the fact that because your skin is of a lighter color, you're not, you don't have your own parents, you were adopted. How did you deal with that as a kid? What did it feel like?
Well, I never believed that I was adopted. But it just felt terrible to be told on many occasions that I was ashamed of my family because of their darker color.
Yeah. And that was all within the same household dehumanization that we went through. And you went through this as a kid, and you grew up, and then you had to deal with all the social stuff outside after that, further seeing it.
Yes,
and now when you see it, you look at it everywhere, and you say, my God, that pain of mine, all of this reminds me of that pain of mine. Everything you're saying is right about slavery, about the possible usage of the bodies. All of that is right.
Mm-hmm.
But where we need to attend when we objectify something is we need to look and say, and where did it happen to me?
I always do that.
And dare I feel this?
I always do.
Yeah, that's what makes you
who you
are. I
always make the connection.
Your name wasn't Iman when you were born, were you? Was it?
Yes, it was.
You were born with that name?
Yes.
Oh, and nobody... How did you get that name, just curiously? How did they pick it for you?
Because of some of the ethnicity in my family. So, it's from my background.
Did you like your name?
Yes.
All right. I'm hearing something about it that probably you don't want to go into. But I want to thank you very much for calling. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Imaya. Armand DeMille here with you with the Positive Mind, 212-209-2900. She makes some awful good points, but again, the place to look is to say, how does this touch me? Not that it is not wrong out there, but the energy that you bring to it, the only healing energy is going to be one where you go in there with clarity. And when you go in with clarity, you find you could do a lot more healing than when you go in with denial and with objectification. 212-209-2900. Armand DeMille, hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
How are you doing today?
I'm going great.
My question is, how do you separate the two from yourself to what you're feeling?
Yeah, well, let me ask you. Give me an example of it. Tell me about yourself and tell me about your feeling.
Well, it has to do with history of family and mother.
Yeah.
Myself and...
Okay, so let's start with the following. Let's not separate. Let's bring it all at home right now. So instead of saying it has to do with history and mother, say it has to do with my history and my mother.
Oh, absolutely.
And, okay, I got that. But you see how that automatically brings it closer?
Mm-hmm.
When you go to history and mother, now you put in my history and my mother. Now we put those two together, and it makes it a little more potent. Now add to that, if you would tell me, what was the greatest pain between you and your mother? The pain that you felt?
The lack of love.
And how did you know she didn't love you? I mean, how did she demonstrate this?
No time.
She had no
time. Enrichment. No dialogue.
Were you one of many children?
Yes.
How many?
Seven.
One of seven children. Very hard things to manage. Did you have a father in the house? Are you still there? Oh, I think we brought it a little too close to home. You're still not there, huh? Yeah, we brought it home. You see, now that's what happens, and that's just the way it happens. It gets close, and I was bringing it home to where he could almost feel it, and the telephone company didn't want him to do it. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Armand DeMille, hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hello, Armand. How are you?
Good.
I have a lot of guilt about sexuality, and I noticed that when I tried to have an orgasm without a partner, when I was masturbating, that it was easier to think about other people or made-up scenarios rather than something that had happened to me. And I thought it was just my guilt. And then I was talking to some other friends of mine, both male, female, straight, gay, and other people also said that it was easier to come, I don't know if I can say that, if they thought about strangers or pornography. And I was wondering, what is this kind of objectification? Is it because we feel guilty?
Well, there's a couple of things going up there. Now, some people feel guilty. Just curiously, after you have an orgasm, do you cry?
No, but I'm loud, and I tell myself I won't be, and I explode when I have it, but I don't cry after.
Yeah, you don't cry. There's no tears.
No.
Okay.
Never happened. Never cried.
Yeah, what happens to a lot of people, and what happens to a lot of people, is that they, in order to heighten the experience, they objectify the sexual experience by recalling a face, an image, an experience, or something they've seen. Because the familiar is too close. You see, here is where the vulnerability comes in. In truth, in its as it is with itself, it doesn't have enough stuff to bring you to this height. Because the vulnerability of a slow building orgasm is a very scary kind of feeling. It's very slow. It takes patience. You know, and if you're somebody who tends to move very fast, you're going to try to add on to it to make it come faster. You know, you want to bring it on faster. Images, what people do, objectifying, pornography, movies, memories. You know, all of that gets added in to try to increase it. Some people use sadomasochistic things to try to increase the pleasure. Just want to add to it. And what you're adding is neurochemicals, hormones. You're adding just about everything by using this plasticity of your brain. You're using your brain to say, okay, give me everything you got to make this a better party. You know, it's let's not just have a banjo. Let's have a banjo and a trumpet and a guitar.
Uh-huh.
And we add all the things together just to kind of make it a heightened experience.
I see.
But it would be interesting to see what it would be like, and not out of the sake of guilt, to see what it would be like to have the experience without the images, even if it took longer. It would be an interesting experiment, you know?
Yes, and I've noticed when I've done that, I've noticed that you're right. It took longer, but what happened is I replaced it with a made-up picture. In other words, I focused on the sensation, and supposing that sensation was my movement was circular, I imagined a fantasy mountain in my mind.
Amazing. Yes, well, you see, this points to your being a very visual person, and that you must have your visual involved in order for you to have that complete experience.
You're right. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, so you're kinesthetic and you're visual. Your body moves. Your body is very alive. It moves to an image. It creates an image. It must have an image of some kind. I wonder what it would be like if you looked in a mirror.
When I was...
Yeah, I wonder if the image you used was your own face.
See, that's the other thing. Because I didn't really have a partner most of my life, I have done that, and I've done that doing different things, and it was very, you're right, I felt very vulnerable, I did get to know myself better after I did do that, and now I'm realizing I don't do that anymore.
Yeah, go say hello to yourself.
Okay, thank you.
Go say to yourself, thanks a lot for calling
okay,
in.
Okay, bye-bye.
So there's the point. You see, as you bring it home and you bring it down to reality and you de-objectify, you know, you take away the objects, you get to that spot that's so much more vulnerable. And I understand, fully understand why people want to avoid it and not be there. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. It is just coming up to 1:30. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, some special music for you, and then we'll continue with phone calls to 212-209-2900. We'll be right back. and that is Sonata in C Minor, number 8, opus number 13, Pathétique. Would you believe? Does that sound like classical music? Well, it is. It's Cuba percussion and klutzboot. So you could go to, if you go to our website, thepositivemind.com, you could always hook up with the music that I play. And as you know, we are given some wonderful gifts of music here. But also, the name of the album is Classic Meets Cuba. So this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Before we tuned into the lovely music, we were talking about objectification, and we had a call from a young woman who spoke about, what do I say, young woman? A call from a person who said that she was talking about when she masturbates and she has a, and she, you know, kind of fantasizes about other things, and it reminded me of David Snarsh. David Snarsh wrote a book called Passionate Marriage. And in Passionate Marriage, he talks about what it's like to look in each other's eyes when you're having an orgasm, not when you're having a simultaneous orgasm, but when either one is having an orgasm, to look in the eyes of your lover at that moment. And he talks about the extreme vulnerability on both persons' part, the one person having the orgasm and the other person who may not be having it simultaneously. But the invitation that is to the soul, to, you know, to the vulnerability, to the nakedness of another person in that spot where they're so undefended. So in some cultures, they absolutely do not allow this. Sex isn't allowed this way. You can't look in the eyes of your partner when you have sex. And in some cultures it is, but you know, it's really a rarity. It's like most people are kind of looking off at the pillow somewhere, or at the ceiling, you know, or doing their nails. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. So we're talking about how we objectify things to protect ourselves from our own feelings of vulnerability, sensitivity, needs. You know, I always say, so if you hear somebody say, I was beaten as a child, I was crucified, I was beaten very badly, you know, that's one thing. If you listen to it, and here's a story I heard about a man who said he was really brutalized as a child. And I went into the story with him, and what it turned out is his father was kind of mean, and his father beat him with a strap. But when I listened, I also said, did you ever get punched? Did you ever get kicked? Did you ever get thrown across a room? Did you ever break a limb? When you have a maniacal parent who is hurting a child, they break things, they smash things, they hurt things, they are unrelenting. I am saying no parent should ever hit any child, but when we, who have been beat by something as a punishment, turn around and say, this was the horrendous experience that turned my whole life into something else, we're objectifying the cruelty. We're making it worse than it is, bigger than it is. When you say, my father left me when I was a kid, therefore, I will never trust another man, you're objectifying that leaving and that father, so that you will never trust another man and take a chance with it. So many times psychology offers people excuses for not getting ahead with their life, but not taking chances. You got to take a chance. Interesting movie, Evan Almighty, which I don't recommend, but it's out there, and I happened to catch a piece of it the other day, and in this piece of the movie, an interesting thing happens. Evan, who is supposed to be Moses, is building an ark, and his wife, because he got a message from God, and God is, and God tells him to build this ark, and then his wife leaves him because she thinks he's going crazy. And she's sitting in a coffee shop, and God appears to her in the form of a waiter. And he says, what's going on? And she says, things are really bad. My husband thinks he's... And she says, why doesn't God save me from this? And God, who's a waiter, right, says to her, you think that God gives answers to people like that? Do you think when a person says, I need to become healthy, God gives them health? You think when a person says, I need wealth, you think God gives them wealth? No, he gives you the opportunity. What, according to, and I'm not preaching for God, I'm saying it nature provides us with. When we have a wish for something, the opportunity, if she has a wish for a great relationship, her husband going wacky and building an ark is an opportunity for her to still make a great relationship by working with her husband instead of leaving him. Opportunities are there all the time that our wishes, the things that we look for to cure our ills, are opportunities, not we're looking for the solution. So the man's not going to come along and the white horse who's going to save all your life. There's going to be a man who will come along, and you may open the door for that man. And now, you see, now you're taking a chance. And you may open that door for looking in that woman's eyes when you're having sex with her. Now you're taking a chance. And you may begin to trust your friend. I can't tell you how many people I interview, number of people I interview, and I interview them and I say to them, and who's your friend? And they tell me their best friend, and I always kind of ask this question. And would you trust your best friend with anything? And the answer is always no. Well, no, I wouldn't tell them about this, or I wouldn't tell them about that. You know, the opportunity to trust, the opportunity to have a friend, to be close to somebody, it's such an enormous opportunity. You don't want to let it slide by. Don't want to let it go numb. These are our chances to get away from objectification. Here's where we get a chance to really see each other and love each other. Armand DeMille, 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there. I sneak these up on Michael. You know, Michael's there and then saying, when's he going to stop talking? Hi, you're on the air. Yes.
What happens if you go to that vulnerable spot that you talked about in looking at the issue at hand, but then others objectify it when you go for help?
Give me an example of it.
I'm sorry?
Give me an example of what you mean.
Well, look at the Kitty Genovese situation.
Well, how? Give me one of yours.
I was raped in the seminary.
Okay.
I was assaulted. And then after that, after coming to grips with it, when this whole crisis in the church came out, and I want to deal with it, and also want to get justice, hold the folks accountable, but try to do it in the way that they themselves, who turn out to be hypocritical, though, say it should be done, fail to acknowledge myself or others. Even have one person say he's going to get me counseling and then says his time is valuable but doesn't get back to me.
So the one place we haven't gotten to is, I understand all of that about what you would do and how you would make make sure the people come to justice and all of that. But the one thing you didn't get to and the one thing that nobody's helped you with is what was truly the experience like. What was it like? Wasn't there, you know, I mean, if you would like, in fact, if you want me to, I'll take 3 minutes and we'll go through it. What was it like? Tell me what it was like to be molested in the by the clergy.
Well, it happened on more than one occasion.
And what was it like? What was that like? What did you feel during those times?
Helpless, unable to do anything about the situation.
Okay, now you weren't confined in a room and tied down.
Well, I had someone on top of me sticking their pecker down my throat.
Yeah, I know. But listen, I mean, you try to keep it as ungraphic as
possible.
Well,
but you're genuine.
I know, but let me tell you. Let me tell you where it's going, okay? I'm on your side. I'm not against you. There's a part of every one of these things, you know, when this happens. If that happens, that's a clear rape. It's a scream. It's you get out of there, you run away, you call the police immediately, right?
Not 30 years ago in the seminary.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's what I'm saying.
And now I'm doing it, and no one's listening.
Okay. What I'm saying is the experience that you have to clear up is what happened 30 years ago and what that experience was for you. Because a part of you has distanced it. Now, when you're bringing it up 30 years later, it comes up with the kind of an energy, you know, that makes people just defend themselves against you, which I fully understand. I understand how difficult this is. But there's a piece of this that you have to grab hold of. There's a piece of this that you have to live for yourself, not just the revenge. There's a part of it that you have to make peace with that you haven't made peace with. And I'll tell you, if you say it was 30 years ago, here's what I know about it. Not only was the sexuality the part abusive, but the fact that there was an acceptance by an elder man of some sort or being valued by an elder man was part of the seduction for that. part of what made it almost got you into the room, showed that there was this need that was there at the same time. And it shows that there was a pain in this boy to start with.
Well, and first of all, it wasn't an elder man. It was a peer.
Uh-huh.
And I had been a virgin, basically, and I was 24. And it was somebody who fits the profile. He came from somewhere else.
You said it happened many times.
It happened with this person forcibly. And then when I tried to discuss it with him, occurred twice others in terms of his being manipulative and intimidated.
Yes,
and
you see, that's what I mean.
Whatever.
So the manipulative part of it is there's a part of you that was, there's a part of you that had a need that was being moved around.
Well, it's called a pseudo-sexuality on the part of church authorities saying that everyone should be celibate. And denying, they're the ones that objectify
sexuality. I can see I'm not getting my point across.
Explain it differently, then.
Well, I'm trying, but I don't seem to be getting to you. What you want to do is keep talking about them, and I want to keep talking about you.
Well, go ahead.
And where I'm saying is there is a piece of this that you have not made peace with. Because every time I point you back to yourself and your needs and what you felt, you point at them. And I say the way you make peace, and I'm on your side. I mean, I want to bring them to justice. I want to make it all happen. But if what I'm talking about today is that we take things like this and we lose sight of ourselves, there was a you back then that you never want to experience again. And we have to make peace with that you. And that takes a little bit of work beyond just the activity of getting even. You know? And then, although I'm not...
Oh, I do know.
What?
I do know. I actually called you and you said you'd get back to me and you never did.
My
difficulty is that I'm a same gender loving person. I am a person who is very comfortable now with my own sexuality. I still feel a calling to ministry. I have my own pro bono peace and justice ministry. I just got back from Rome and protested outside of the Vatican on the invitation of a party that showed the hand of God, the documentary.
And I certainly will return your call. I have to be going right now.
Well, you didn't the first time.
Well, that's sometimes I do that. You know, I try my best.
Well, you're the one who said that your time is valuable, and I must say, not getting the call back was very, very...
Hurt you a lot. I'm sorry I didn't call you back. Something must have gotten in the way.
It was
sometimes
objectified.
I tried... What?
I think you objectified it.
Maybe I did. Maybe I just said it's a piece of paper.
Bye now.
Bye. Oh, the anger seethes through everywhere, you see, and it's hard to let go of it. It's hard. It's hard to put it down. It's hard to say, Armand, I need you. Would you please talk to me? Instead of that, it's the accusation and the assault, and what happens when you do that is you get the reaction back from people. And then all of a sudden you wonder, why are people treating me this way? You got to tackle it somewhere at the core, my friends. 212-20, but I will return his call. 212-209-2900, Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, hello, Armand. This is a first-time caller.
Hey, congratulations.
But it's incidentally true that I know a little bit about the field because I got a Harvard PhD in cognitive psychology.
Good old cog psych, I love it.
And it also...
Have you been following this work of this Deutsch, this neuroplasticity?
I was fascinated. I'm going to look at that book.
Yeah, it's great.
But it also is true that about the same time in the 70s when I started listening to BAI, I read all of the classics of humanistic psychology. I have nothing against humanistic psychology, and I have nothing against you. But since we're on the topic of objectification, I'm going to make an oblique comment. I think that that the station is objectifying a lot of the BAI audience by assuming that the audience naturally wants most of the producers to be life tenured. And you know about the great work of Nobel laureate Eric Kandel.
Sure.
That if a snail had the ability to listen to BAI, and a snail doesn't live for 25 years, but if the snail was listening to the same basic things on BAI for the majority of its lifespan, it is scientific truth that the average donations of the snail as an output would decline.
What's your name, by the way?
Prize for that.
What's your name?
My name is Elliot.
Elliot, hi. Elliot, I take what you say, I take it seriously because I think, you know, if you knew WBAI, you know that they do not have a feeling of seniority, that they are really, like every other radio station, ready to get rid of anybody if something better comes along. So I think they are doing both. I'm not defending the station, and I don't want to talk about station politics. But I understand what you're saying, you know, that there's we all do it, you know. There's a way of objectifying the audience objectifies the station. We tend to do it to each other, and if there's just a way that we could collaborate a little better, where we could reach down into our open hearts as opposed to our protests, and try to find some way to hold hands in this venture of WBAI, as opposed to confronting each other with protest signs, you know, if we could just find a way to collaborate, this would be a far greater, even greater station than it is now.
And I'm just saying that all vital cultural institutions need a pressure for change.
Absolutely.
And it just is not right for the institution to say that, well, our audience doesn't really want change if the audience hasn't actually been consulted. You know, it's the old saying from Paul Newman, what we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah, I understand. Elliot, thank you very much. Sure, 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. You know, and there's another one, you know, when we objectify the establishment. Sometimes we objectify the establishment because we feel so powerless. You know, the establishment is bad because, it's in our powerlessness that we kind of, it's where it starts. You know? 212-209-2900, Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. My thing is that, I'm very nervous. My thing is that when I get into a relationship, shortly afterwards, I get, like, extremely jealous to the point where it destroys the relationship. And I've been in relationships for like 7-9 years. Then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, extreme jealousy and possessiveness, and out goes the relationship.
Yeah. And is it usually unfounded jealousy? And
it's usually, it's some of it is founded, some of it is unfounded, but it's like too, like overwhelming, like this obsessive thought about what's he doing, who's he doing it with, and you know, it just like kind of
been there a few times in your life, right? And you were there. I bet you were there as a teenager too.
As a teenager, I remember somebody feeling like that towards me.
Towards that way, towards you,
my first husband.
Very jealous towards you. Very possessive of you.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about neuroplasticity in the brain, and we're going to be doing a further special on this during the fun drive. But one of the things they found in association with certain levels of vulnerability, you have a relationship, and it goes on for a certain period of time. Now, I'm going to say to you, when did this happen? Every 7-8 years? How often? When you're in a relationship, how often does this happen? How often?
Well, it's not. Once it happens, the relationship is destroyed.
Okay, but when does it happen? About the first 5 years, the first 7 years, the first 3 years?
It's like in the first 7 years.
Now, let me ask you something about that. I know you picked that number for a reason. How old are you now?
56.
When you were 7 years old, were your mother and father living at home?
Yeah, yes.
And what was your parents like? What were your parents like? What was your mom like? What was your dad like?
My mother was like, stay home. As long as he doesn't disrespect your house, he can do whatever he wants in the street.
Meaning your father?
Yeah.
You see? So there you are at age 7, watching your mother, giving permission to your father to be unfaithful to her. And she's telling you about this, and you're a little kid.
Right.
And you're a little kid losing your daddy to the streets with your mother telling you you shouldn't feel this way. And you had to wonder, is my daddy coming home? Is my daddy going to have another family? Did your father ever get another family?
Eventually he had children in the street. And
so that's what you're dealing with, you see. You're dealing with this little girl whose father left her, abandoned her, went to have other children in the street, and she's a little girl who felt so terribly vulnerable, yet when she turned to her mother and she says, Mom, what's going on? Your mom says, well, as long as he comes home, that's all that seems to matter. And this vulnerability, this ache is what I'm talking about. This is what controls our lives. If we were to go and fix that, if you wanted to fix that propensity... If you wanted to fix that propensity, that's what you use good counseling for. That's what you could use good therapy for. Because that's what it does. It goes back. It takes you back there. You know, you get to work with somebody like Stephanie Dombra or one of the people who do the most intense work, or Yamini. These people who do this very strong work at fixing the very place where everything got broke.
What's that name, Stephanie?
Dombra. D-A-M-B-R-A.
D-A-M-B-R-T?
D-A-M-B-R-A. I'll tell you what, go to my website, thepositivemind.com, and you click on the staff, and you'll see she works at the center I work at. But these are the people that do the stuff, you know, just to get you past it. But you got to get back to the root of it. You got to remember where it started, instead of thinking that it's all truly taking place in the present. That's where all prejudice, that's where all violence, all pogrom, all this meanness comes from. It comes from the fact that we want to not feel the way we felt when we were once little and didn't know how to handle life.
I never remember feeling like that as a child.
Yeah, exactly. See, now that's exactly what I mean. We shut off the memory, and it appeared later. That's why when you go back to it and you uncover it, that's when you clean it out, and that's when you don't have to live that way anymore. What's your name?
Well, I'm afraid to say my name.
Okay, don't say your name, but when you call, say from the radio, okay?
Okie doke.
Thanks for calling.
The radio. All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you wanted to reach us, you can reach us at 212-757-4488. This is Armand DeMille with you, with the Positive Mind. We're going to be leaving you, and we will be back with you on Tuesday. No? Oh, not until the 11th, huh? Make sure you go to the website to find out the schedule for the marathon, which is coming up. Back are you on Wednesday at 1 p.m., I think it's going to be. And we'll be back with you for a two-hour special. Speak to you soon, my friends. Nice to be with you.
Why doesn't it come?
Were you waiting for me, Dan Malley?
Who's that? Who spoke?
The Shadow.
The Shadow?
There isn't much time, Malley. They're coming after you to take you to the chair. Speak quickly. What have you to say?
Just this. For the best in old-time radio thrills, adventure, and comedy, tune in to the Golden Age of Radio, 7 to 9, Sunday nights, right here on WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Tony Trischka, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
If this were 5 o'clock on a Thursday, that music would mark the beginning of Behind the News. But it's not, so instead I'm here to invite you to join me, Doug Henwood, as I comment on the economic news and interview a wide variety of guests. Authors, activists, think tankers, and even the occasional Nobel Prize winner. Economics and politics from New York City to the world. What's happening and what it all means. Behind the News with Doug Henwood, Thursdays from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on WBAI.